This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that if you take the time to know their stories, you'll be amazed by the things that they've done, the things that they've endured for the sake of our freedom. Maybe your hometown is Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Maybe it's Rio Rancho, New Mexico. If so, you're going to be excited to hear today from 93-year-old Seth Irving, who grew up on a reservation in South Dakota but has lived the last 30 years here in the Albuquerque area. Navy veteran of World War II with a Purple Heart license plate on a purple car. I've never seen that before. That was fun. Take me back a few years, if you can. Growing up as a child in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, what was your native tribe?
Oglala Lakota.
Oglala Lakota.
Yeah.
That's part of the Sioux Nation.
That's part of the Sioux Nation of Pine Ridge.
So there in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, what was your childhood like? What kinds of things did you do there?
There wasn't much of anything to do because even my parents didn't have good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to school at a Holy Rosary Mission Indian School. I went there when I was first grade, and I stayed there at that mission from 1929 to 1939. I went to school during the winter months and worked for my board and room during the summer months.
What kind of work was that?
All kinds of work, you know, milking cows and stuff like that. They had a blacksmith shop.
Oh, okay.
We helped make barrels, you know, and buckets out by hand at that time. I had several different kinds of jobs. Whatever they needed, I did during the summertime.
And here in New Mexico, people hear quite a bit about the Navajo impact on World War II, the Navajo code talkers, where their native language actually became a weapon in the war and was an unbreakable code that the Japanese could never crack. But for you growing up in South Dakota, you weren't allowed to speak a native language.
No, I was disallowed just about the time I started going to school. So my older brother, two of them, spoke fluently. But ever after that, all of us were forbidden to speak in school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we never did learn a language that good. Just words here and there.
Sure.
Know?
You mentioned your brothers. How many siblings did you have?
I had three brothers and five sisters.
Wow.
In 1942, when I joined, two of them were already in the service.
Mm-hmm.
My older brother, Chester, was a MP because he had police training, you know. And then my second brother, he couldn't make it because he had an eardrum burst. So he was 4F.
Mm-hmm.
And then my third brother was in the Navy before I was. And I don't know where he went to. I just know he was in the Navy.
But they both made it home, the other two that were serving.
Yeah, they both made it home, and everybody was home when I got back.
And you were pretty fortunate to come back after what you went through. We're going to hear about that, but I also want to touch on something that I think is significant. All three of you boys made it home from the war, but you didn't have any parents to come home to. You lost your parents at an early age.
Yes, I did. My father died in 29. And my mother died in March of 42.
And it was in 42, so you're done with high school by then. Your mother dies, and 6 months later, you join the Navy.
Yes.
What was it about the Navy that made you want to join that branch of service as opposed to another, so much that you would lie about your age to do it?
It was by accident, really. There were three of us young Indians who lived on the reservation. We knew we were in draft age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to go join the Marines, but the closest recruiting office was in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So we hitchhiked to Cheyenne, Wyoming, all three of us, kind of rotated, you know,
mm-hmm.
going down. People picked us up. Anyway, we got down there in Cheyenne, and here, the day we were there, the Marine recruiting station was going overhaul, you know. So they were closed for a week. And there we were with no money or nothing. And we was walking up the street wondering what we were going to do. We were we were thinking of coming home, you know.
Sure.
And here there was a Navy flag waving on the street. And so we huddled up and they said, well, we're just going to the Navy. So we walked into that door and wound up in the Navy by accident.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
Well, I like to say God's plans are always better than ours, and that's a good one right there. Yeah. So you're 20 years old at the time, but you told them you were 21.
Yes, I did that because one of the three of us, he wasn't 21. He was at the same age as me, 20, and they wouldn't sign him up until he got his parental consent.
Right.
His parents were still alive, so he had to come back to the res, hitchhike back to the res, get his parents' signature and come back.
Wow.
So he got into the Navy about a week later than we did.
So you saw what happened to him. You said, I'm not going to deal with that, and my parents aren't around to call me a liar.
And no, we were already gone when when he got back.
I know this was a long time ago,
yeah.
More than 70 years ago, but do you remember what you expected out of the Navy, what you thought it was going to be like?
Really, we did not. But I was just pleased with my Navy service.
I'm just guessing that growing up on a reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, you probably hadn't been on a ship before you joined the Navy?
No, I never even saw one. So,
well, I'm sure that changed in a hurry.
Yeah.
And the first ship that you were on was the USS Endicott, a destroyer?
Yes.
What was that like, getting aboard a tin can and getting to know all these other sailors from all over the country?
Boy, everything from the time I left the res was all new to me, you know. Riding a train from Cheyenne to Farragut, Idaho, my naval training station, was all new. And, of course, the Navy training was all new. Everything was. I never expected anything of that sort.
Was it kind of exciting for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was great. Like I said, I really enjoyed the Navy. But at that time, I think we were having 6 weeks of boot training, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when that 6 weeks came up, I wound up with hives.
Ah.
And so the first draft, they call them, when they assign you to your next station, you know.
Yeah.
I was withheld on that draft because of my hives. I had them under my arms, both sides. And then about a week or two later, I was on a second draft. My doctor withheld me from that one. And I don't know what those ships were that I was assigned to at, or stations where I was assigned to. And then the third draft came up. I was on it about a month after I got out of boot training. I was assigned to the USS Endicott.
And you just answered what was going to be my next question. Have you ever figured out what other ships you might have been on? But who knows? I mean, there were plenty of destroyers that went down in World War II. You could have been assigned to one of those.
Yeah.
How long were you on the Endicott?
I was on the Endicott about 8 months. And we went from Bremerton, Washington, all the way around to Boston, Mass., and we escorted merchant marine ships all the way to Casablanca.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the Germans were still in North Africa at that time.
Yeah, you're talking about, what, late 1943?
Yeah, it was around May, June, July of 43.
So the U-boat threat was still there.
That's what our primary function was, to hunt the submarines down.
Did you ever find any?
We made several runs. Of course, we don't know what, you know, there was no proof of everything coming up, you know.
Sure.
But we made several runs on subs while we were going and also while we were coming back with the empties.
Mm-hmm. And what were your duties on the ship? What was your battle station?
Well, I was just a seaman second class, so my battle station duty was on the bridge as a lookout.
Mm-hmm.
I was furnished great big binoculars, you know, and so every time we went to general quarters, that's where I went, and my job was to watch for submarine periscopes and torpedo wakes, etc.
Yeah.
And that's what my job was during the period of general quarters.
That sounds like a little bit of pressure. That's your job to see that stuff, and if you don't see it, what are the consequences?
Yeah, I don't know. The seas were pretty rough, mm-hmm. and it was very difficult to identify torpedo wake. But we had a new instrument, was a sonar.
Yep.
Which could spot them. That's what we used to chase German submarines with.
Were you involved in that part of it, or you just knew about it?
No, my duties were up above, you know. Most of them were in below the bridge.
Were you ever nervous or scared during that time?
I don't think I was ever scared.
Didn't really have anyone shooting at you yet.
Couldn't see anybody shooting anyway.
Might have been under the surface,
yeah,
but you didn't
they
know.
They were under the water if they were. Yeah. But there was several ships sunk by submarines while we were going, you know.
Not in your convoy, though.
Yeah, in our
convoy. In your convoy.
Yeah.
That has to be alarming.
Those German submarines were awful smart, by golly.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So in November of 43, you get transferred to a different destroyer.
Yes.
The Newcomb.
Yeah.
What was different about that ship compared to the Endicott?
It was larger.
Uh-huh.
It had more fireworks to it. It had five-inch guns. It had all kinds of anti-aircraft, and that's what I was on, was the anti-aircraft.
You were on the 40s?
40 millimeter. That's
so you had a pretty clear understanding of what your job was going to be?
Yes, I did.
To shoot down enemy airplanes?
Yes.
Had you seen any enemy airplanes yet, though?
Not then, but later on, we used to fire on the islands, too, you know. We bombarded the landing areas 3-4 days before landing mm-hmm. of the troops, and that was our job. But our primary job was to protect the old battle wagons and other big ships from submarines in that before we started to bombard the islands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of clear out the sea, so to speak, before you bombard, you know.
What was your first taste of real combat, the first encounter you had with the enemy where you said, boy, this is real. I could lose my life doing this.
It was a small island, Eniwetok.
Eniwetok, okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Eniwetok was out there.
Yeah.
So that's the first place. Eniwetok was where you first saw the Japanese.
Yes.
And from that point on, really for the rest of your time in the Navy, you guys were pretty much battle to battle, huh? Sailing from one island to the other to
yes.
bombard a new one?
Yes, that's what we did. We bombarded the island, and we stayed there for about 10 days after landing. Then we would pull back and, of course, load up, reload ammo and everything, and then we're prepared for the next landing. And then we talked, and there was another little small island we landed on before we landed on Saipan. Got through Saipan, we went on back to the South Pacific. We were down there patrolling for several months. And then we gathered together again with the bombardment group, and we bombarded Lady Goff about 3-4 days before troops landed there.
Right.
That lady. And while we were there, my ship was involved with the Sarigao Strait. Uh-huh. battle, and we were credited with sinking or help sink one of the Japanese's big battle wagons
uh-huh.
at Sarigao Straits.
Can you help us understand what it's like in one of those battles when you're at that duty station, when you're on that 40 millimeter and everything is firing?
I have no knowledge of getting any fear or anything of that nature, even though during that battle I could see the enemy's firing at us and missing 50 yards, 100 yards off of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But I was on the 40 millimeter, so I couldn't fire.
You weren't going to reach them.
But I could see the torpedo men. We had torpedo launchers on both sides of the ship and four of them, you know, and we made that run. I was up there and I just watched the torpedo men release those torpedoes off of our ship into the sea. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was dark, and we couldn't see where it was going. But we could see them firing at us at a distance, you know.
Yeah.
I never got scared or fear, or I didn't panic. You know, we did have sailors who got panicky, you know.
Sure. You say that. You know, you never got scared.
No.
Why do you think that was? What do you think it was that helped you keep your calm or believe that you were going to make it?
It must have been the training, because I never got fearful of anything. Mm-hmm. I just had a job to do, and I had to do it, you know.
Yeah.
On that Cerro, I didn't have much to do, except the next morning, when the sun rose, Japanese planes came over, and then we went to work and shot at all the planes that were coming in, hundreds of them. But we didn't get hit. We almost did, but we didn't.
When you're in a moment like that, the Japanese planes are coming in, and you know you might be one of the guys that prevents it from hitting your ship or from bombing your ship.
Yeah.
Do you feel an adrenaline rush? What does that feel like in those kind of moments?
I don't think I had any kind of adrenaline feeling. I just felt like it was a job to be done, and I better do it right, or else, you know. I suppose that one morning I fired at 50 planes that came at us, not necessarily our particular ship. There wasn't any kamikazes at that time. They weren't trying to suicide bomb. They weren't doing that. It was just about a month after that is when they started the suicide bombing all over the place.
And you would know that all too well by April of 1945. It's time to take a break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Seth Irving's experience at Iwo Jima and at Okinawa, where the last-minute words of a shipmate helped save his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.